Programming is supported by Patterson, Tinti, Scar, and Christensen, serving the intellectual property needs of creative and inventive clients worldwide. Online at ptslaw.com.
Two blockbuster hours on money that you won't want to miss. I'm Carrie Miller. This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. This hour, with the clock ticking towards tax day, we're going to talk about the mistakes and the myths around tax planning and some of those write-offs you might want to think twice about. Next hour, the mistakes and magical thinking of retirement planning with Ruth Hayden. Why we think we'll need so much less than we really will. But first to Sandy Block. She's the personal finance columnist for USA Today, and she joins us from Washington. Sandy, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And for our listeners, if you have questions this hour about tax planning and common tax mistakes, Sandy has been writing a lot about it over the last month. Here's your chance to ask her a question about it, and here's the number, 800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, nprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question. So if you are in the midst of preparing your taxes, you're trying to hit that deadline next week, and you've run up against some obstacles, or you have questions about some things that you can deduct, this is an opportunity, and we're going to dispel some of the myths that people have about taxes. Again, the number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, online at nprnewsq.org. Click on Send Us a Question. I know we'll get a lot of calls. Let the lines ring. If the call doesn't get answered, call us back, and we'll get to your call. So, Sandy, here's the first thing I want to talk about, and I think this is a myth and a mistake that might be common about the idea of April 15th. Are there people who think, that's a movable deadline. I'll just get an extension and it won't cost me anything.
Well, that's a really big mistake because it is very easy to get an extension. And I would encourage people who don't owe the IRS any money, who are pretty sure they're going to get a refund, if they don't have their act together, go ahead and file an extension by next week and you get 6 more months. It's automatic and it's no big deal. But if you owe the IRS money, filing an extension does not give you more time to pay. And after April 15th, if you owe money, the clock starts ticking and you start owing interest and penalties on whatever it is that you owe.
Okay, so just to be clear here, even if the IRS is okay with your extension, you're still going to pay what penalties because you have not paid them by the 15th.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
If you owe money, it is due on April 15th. There are some, very rare circumstances where you can get more time to pay, and there are things that you can do if you can't pay, which we can talk about. But filing for an extension does not give you more time to pay. It only gives you more time to file.
Let's talk about what you can do if you can't pay by the 15th.
Well, there are a lot of options, and one that is becoming increasingly popular but also problematic is using your credit card. The IRS will accept credit. It will accept all the major credit cards, just like Macy's and everybody else. But there are a couple of problems with that. One is that you will pay the processing fee, usually 2.35%. You pay. The IRS doesn't eat the processing fee like companies do. So automatically you're going to pay that in addition to whatever it is that you owe. The other problem that's sort of new this year is that so many people have had their credit card limits lowered in the last few months because the credit card industry has become so much more risk averse and trying to cut people out, that a big credit card bill could potentially exceed your limit or at the very least test it, and that could hurt your credit score.
Yeah, so if you think you're going to put whatever you owe the IRS on a credit card, you better check out where your limit is at.
Yeah, right? I would do that first thing. And the final thing I would say about this is that people, a few years ago, I remember people, especially people who had big tax bills, maybe they own their own business, would charge their taxes because they wanted to get the reward.
Yeah.
Well, the rewards have just gotten so much more stingy now that in many cases, say a 1% cash back, if you get is not going to exceed 2.35% of the processing fee. So in many cases, the amount that you pay to use your credit card is not going to exceed, the rewards are not going to exceed the amount that you have to pay up front to use your credit card. So I think the whole rewards angle is a lot less attractive now because there just aren't as many of those out there.
Let's take some calls from our listeners here to Tom in St. Paul. Hi, Tom. Your question for Sandy Block.
Yeah, hi. I've got a complicated situation, I think. My daughter just graduated from college, so we're not claiming her on our taxes, but she worked in two states and is still a a resident of Minnesota. So she worked in Connecticut and Washington, D.C., which isn't even a state.
But we do pay taxes here.
Yeah. So, and she doesn't owe any taxes. But I'm trying to figure out how to file all these different forms. Do I file in D.C. and Connecticut and Minnesota and the federal form?
Oh my gosh.
I would file an extension if you haven't done it yet, just because it sounds like it's going to take a while to unravel this. Multi-state filings are complicated, and I was talking to someone the other day about this, and it's a problem because states have become much more aggressive about going after people who may have worked or lived in their state for part of the year because they really need the money. So I would say one thing you might want to do is file an extension, and you might want to get some. I'm doing a lot of writing now about whether to do your own taxes or have someone do it. This might be a case where you might want to get some advice, because it sounds complicated. If you use tax software, which I think works very well, you're going to end up paying a lot of money because you're going to have to file in all these different states. And even if your daughter doesn't owe anything, the IRS may owe her because she may have had withholding taken out of her income, and if she doesn't file, she won't get that money back.
Yeah, Tom, seems like it would be worth the $200 fee just to turn it over to some tax professional and let them worry about it.
I would file an extension to get yourself more time and then maybe talk to somebody.
What do you say, Sandy, about going to the pros to have your taxes prepared?
I think that taking this caller's daughter, say if she were newly employed, renting, had income withheld from her, taxes withheld from her wages, no kids, someone like that really should not pay, in my opinion, $100 or more to have their taxes done.
Really?
She probably files a 1040 EZ. She can do it for free on IRS Free File if she makes less than $57,000 or made less than $57,000. And it's just not worth the money. Software does that so, so very well. I just think it's a waste of money to pay somebody to do a simple form. If you have self-employment income, rental income, lots of kids, you got divorced, and you know all kinds of major life things, then I think you really do need to think about getting help because your tax return can get complicated. And I think what a lot of people end up doing isn't they're so worried about getting audited, but I think what really happens is a lot of people overpay.
Really?
Because there are so many deductions and credits now available for everything you can think of, from college education to putting insulation in your home. And tax software does do a pretty good job of walking you through these things, but I still think in a lot of cases, if your situation is complicated, and I really emphasize this for people with self-employment income because I think that is a really complicated issue, it's probably worth your while to pay somebody to get some help.
We'll talk about some of those tax credits because you've been writing about those, but let's go back to the phones now to Louise in Minneapolis. Hi, Louise. Your question for Sandy Block.
Hi. My question is about health savings accounts. It seems to me the TurboTax didn't have very good instructions, and I'm really confused about the fact that the bank has until May to send you your form, because people can contribute to IRAs until April 15th, but you're supposed to report what you had at the end of December. And then the other question I have is, what's your recommendation with respect to using the investment option that the bank offers besides just the straight savings account for the HSA?
Sandy?
I would look at that, and frankly, the tax issues associated with HSAs, I'm not really qualified to address. I was just looking at a question about that. That money is not supposed to be taxable, but I assume that the IRS wants you to report it anyway so they know where it is, because if you use it properly, you don't pay taxes on it. Since HSAs are so new, I think this issue of who should manage it should really just come down to fees. Look and see what they're charging you, and go for the lowest fee of all would be my first thought. And then if you are going to invest this money, obviously you're going to look at investment options. I think if you're getting an HSA through an employer, they tend to have an account associated with your insurance policy that might, just from an administrative point of view, make sense. But if you're on your own, these are so new, I think I would look around and look and see what, first and foremost, I'd look and see what they're charging you to maintain that account. That would be my primary thing.
Sandy, here's another myth. I'm married, so I am required to file a joint tax return. That is not true, is it?
No, it's not true, but for most married couples, it's the most advantageous tax situation.
Why is that?
Because the IRS does not want to make it, or the Congress and the IRS has specifically designed the tax code so married couples can't lower their taxes by filing separately. Because if they did, everybody would. I mean, if you could pay less by filing separately, wouldn't you? I would. So for most people, they pay less filing jointly. And there are some very valuable credits and deductions that you can't even take or are lowered tremendously if you file separately. So there are a lot of penalties to doing it. There are certain situations where it does make sense. If one spouse has very, very, very large medical bills, might be one. And the other, frankly, is if you think your spouse is cheating or underpaying or doing something unsavory, then you might want to file separately just to absolve yourself of responsibility.
You meant for those cheating
things.
The IRS,
yeah,
not cheating,
cheating
on you.
Cheating on you. Well, maybe then too. But I mean cheating on his taxes or her taxes.
Sandy Block is with us this morning. She's a personal finance columnist for USA Today, and we've asked her to come in and spend the hour with us. She's been writing a lot about taxes, mistakes, and myths around tax preparation. We thought that'd be an interesting hour. Next hour, Ruth Hayden here, and we talk about the myths and the magical thinking that goes on as people plan for their retirement. I know Ruth will have some interesting anecdotes about this. She always does. This hour, though, it's about taxes. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Online with us this morning, nprnewsq.org. Click on Send Us a Question. Online question here, Sandy, from Ben in Edina, who says, if I have a full-time and a part-time job, am I able to deduct the mileage I travel between those two jobs?
This is, again, one of those issues where I would say he might want to talk to a professional, but I don't think so. If you are self-employed and you use your car for your work, use your car to visit customers, generally that mileage is deductible. But in general, the cost of commuting is not deductible.
Okay.
You can't deduct the cost of going to work or going home from work, so I suspect that you probably can't deduct the cost of going from one job to the other. Where this could potentially get complicated is if his part-time job is maybe self-employed or something like that. But if he's working for people, then I would say no, those costs are not deductible.
And when we say consult a professional, what about the idea of calling the IRS? Can you get a good answer out of those people?
I would go to their website before I would call.
Okay.
They've put a lot of resources into their website, and actually a lot of the information there is very good and very helpful. If you call, certainly around now, you're going to be guaranteed a wait time.
Mm-hmm.
And just from what I hear from people, it's very, you know, you may get a very helpful person and you may not. You know, it just really kind of depends on who answers the phone. But I think it can be a frustrating experience to try and call the IRS. So I would look to their website first.
All right. From Jay in St. Paul, he says, I applied for the $8,000 first-time home buyer's tax credit in early February. I'm wondering about current processing time and who to contact to get an update. So many tax credits this time to figure out, Sandy.
Well, the homebuyer one is, I mean, he's just going to have to sit tight, because what's happened with the homebuyer one is they didn't even start processing, because it's a new credit and then Congress amended it late last year. The IRS didn't even start processing returns it received until mid-February, I think.
Mm.
And the other problem is, because you are required to attach your settlement statement to your tax return when you claim that credit, and this is an anti-fraud thing, the IRS isn't doing those returns electronically. It's processed. It required you to send in a paper return. If you send in a paper return, it takes the IRS 4 to 6 weeks to process it. So if he sent it in February, you know, I wouldn't even bother calling. He's probably just not going to get it until, you know, maybe he doesn't hear anything by the end of this month. But it's going to take a while. That's just the bottom line there.
To the phones, to Jay in Rochester. Hi, Jay. Your question.
I'm wondering how much of your earned income you can discount, that is, not pay taxes on, by offsetting it with non-retirement losses from stock sales.
Wow.
Well, basically how that works is if you lost money on your investments and it's not in a retirement account last year, the first thing you have to do is offset any losses against any gains that you had. So if you sold anything for a profit, you use those losses to offset any gains. If you had no gains, or you've already offset the gains and you still have losses, you can claim up to $3,000. You can deduct up to $3,000 against your income. That's the limit. Now, the other thing, too, though, and this is where keeping records is so important, is if you had more than $3,000 in losses, you can carry it over to next year and use it to offset gains or take it against your income, your 2010 income. But the maximum that you can deduct in a year in losses is $3,000.
Let's circle back here, Sandy, to some of the other tax credits, because, again, I've been reading your columns where you're writing about this. Let's talk about the energy saving tax credits. I think a number of people took advantage of that. What do you need to know about how to claim that when you're filing your taxes?
Well, my concern with that one is that some people may – this may be one that people will overlook, because people kind of know that putting in insulation or windows or an energy-efficient thing and might qualify for this credit, which is worth up to $1,500. What they might not realize, and this happened to me, is maybe last year your furnace gave up or your air conditioning broke down and you
right.
replaced it. Well, that qualifies if it meets the energy efficient guidelines, that qualifies too. And you could easily, you know, it, basically how the credit works is 30% of your costs up to a maximum of $1,500. You'd
not
have to spend $5,000
yeah.
to get the full credit. But if you replace your AC, or certainly if you put in new windows, you could hit that. Now, what the IRS says is you can rely on the manufacturer's certification to claim this credit. And the manufacturers should be able to tell you whether these windows, your AC, whatever you put in, qualifies for meets the government standards for energy efficiency. So if you don't already have it, check with the manufacturer, and that should be enough to prove to the IRS that you actually spent the money on something that meets the energy efficiency standards.
And is there an obvious place? Let's say you're doing your own filing and you're using the electronic form. There's an obvious place where you note that on the form?
Well, you don't have to send in the certification. You just keep it,
okay.
basically. Like so many other things, charity receipts and all these other things, the IRS doesn't require you to mail them in. You keep them in case the IRS comes back and says, you know, we don't really think this looks too good. So you keep them in your records so you can prove that this was a legitimate credit or deduction if the IRS asks.
I've got some questions about charities, but we'll come back to that to go to the phones here to Nick in Minneapolis. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm currently behind on my mortgage by a lot of months, let's just say, most of 2009. I'm wondering, since that debt's still piling up on my account, can I write the mortgage interest off?
No, unfortunately, you can't. I'm very sorry to hear about that. But that is because a house is not considered something that you can typically deduct. So I don't think that you can write off the losses in your mortgage. But this might be something I would recommend talking to a professional about how to deal with this. But I don't know of any way that you can reduce your taxes by basically the loss of value of your home.
Online here from Tanya, listening in Iowa. Sandy, she says, I need to correct my 2009 tax returns. What's the quickest way to do it? I did it online originally.
You will file an amended return. And if you did it online, the program probably has the form for it. If not, you can find it at irs.gov. But basically, you get you file an amended return, you put in the information that you originally had, and then you put in the correct information. And if this works out in your favor, eventually you should get a refund from the IRS. If it works against you, then you'll probably need to send in a check.
I want to ask you about something that you wrote that I was really surprised at when I read this. One of the most common mistakes is that people write their Social Security numbers or their kids' Social Securities down wrong.
Yeah, and that really, they do that, and, you know, I'm not sure, I mean, good tax software sometimes will catch that, you know, if there's a discrepancy between your social one place. But your Social Security number is how the IRS identifies you. And if there's any and it's also for them considered a big red flag for fraud.
Oh.
So if there's any discrepancy between your number and your name, if you're e-filing, it'll reject your return immediately. And if you file by paper, you could end up being held up in limbo for a long time.
Yes, and you won't get your refund if you're doing it for a long time.
It's really important that you put, if you claim children or anyone else's dependents, you need to include their Social Security numbers. This is part of modern life that wasn't the case when I was born, that you need to get a Social Security number for your kids right away, because that's how the IRS determines that they are legitimate dependents.
To the phones to John in Minnetonka. Hi, John.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
This is kind of a twist on the home buyer's tax credit. I purchased, or I will close on a building lot in Minnetonka on the 20th of April, and I'm wondering if that would qualify for the home buyer's tax credit.
I don't think so. I think you need to put a house on it, and I don't think you have time, because this this current credit expires at the end of this month. And you have to basically sign your settlement papers by the end of this month, or sign a purchase agreement by the end of this month. I don't think the land alone will qualify, and I think, like I said, I don't know that you really have time to put a house on top of it.
John, you need to build that house in 10 days.
Yeah.
Can you do that?
Trailer home maybe, but I'm not sure.
There you go. And Sandy, let me ask you about some of the charity deductions here. You mentioned that you need to have receipts, or you want receipts from all charitable contributions that you make. I've run into situations, especially like after Haiti, and we'll talk about that as a special case, but where the charities are pretty overwhelmed and you can't get a receipt from them. What do you do then?
You can use your own. I mean, a receipt from the charity is nice, but if you, presumably you didn't send them cash, I hope.
No, it was an online deal.
Online deal, and you used a credit card.
Yes.
So you should have a credit card record of that. That will support your, I think the IRS would accept that as, you know, a credit card, a canceled check, those types of things will support your, will substantiate your contribution. And that is a problem. I wrote about this a while back, that people sometimes, you know, because they didn't get a letter from the charity, they don't claim legitimate charitable contributions, and that's why it's a good idea to keep your own records and not rely on them.
Okay. And there is a special exception this year for Haiti, isn't there?
Yes. If you made a donation to Haiti between, I got to get my dates right, January 12th and the end of February, I think it was, you can deduct that on this year's tax return, on your 2009 tax return, instead of waiting until you file next year. And basically, Congress, they did this a few years ago with the tsunami in Southeast Asia as well. It's to encourage people to give. You don't have to claim it. If you think you'd rather hold on to the deduction until next year, that's fine. But if you want to get, you lower your taxes right away, you can do that. And as I said, it's just a special exception to encourage people to give, because that tragedy happened so soon after the end of the year that, you know, there's a concern that a lot of people might forget to claim the deduction if they wait until next April.
Online here from Mary in Plymouth, she says, while discussing the energy credit, you didn't mention that labor costs cannot be deducted, only materials. Contractors know this and will provide.
That's true, and that's a good point. Although I think there's a distinction between, that's true for some projects and not for others. I think you're right that you can't deduct, you can't claim labor costs for, say, putting in new insulation. But some of the more ambitious projects that have even larger credits, such as like putting solar panels on your home, I do think that in that case you can count labor. So, but the manufacturers can help you with that.
Let me take a call from Barbara in St. Paul. Hi, Barbara. Thanks very much for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
No
your question.
Problem. Great program. I noticed when I was doing my taxes on TurboTax this year, there are some special credits for housing people that are affected by disasters, and like Haiti and a couple years ago Katrina, et cetera. I was wondering if our current economic situation counts as a disaster. My husband's brother and his wife lost their jobs and house in Nashville and have lived with us for a year, which is just economically devastating.
Yes.
And
wow.
they have simple unemployment income for him, and that's it. And every bill has doubled. Are there any credits? Is there anything I can do?
I'm not aware of anything. That's a really interesting situation, and I actually probably should do some more research about housing people who are victims of disaster. But I am not aware of anything that's available to people like you and people across the country, good-hearted people who have taken in folks who've lost their jobs. Unfortunately, I'm just sort of going through my mind, and I doubt these people qualify as dependents. Sometimes when you take in a parent, or an older child, you might be able to claim that person as a dependent if they have no other income. But that doesn't sound like the case here. So I'm just a little bit of a loss of what you could claim to sort of offset the money that you're spending to help these people out.
Sandy, let me ask you this, since you've mentioned the claiming the children as dependents. Is there an upper age level on that? Because we're hearing about a lot of older kids moving back in with
their
parents.
Yeah, there is, and it depends on whether your child's in college or not. If your child is a full-time student, you can claim him or her as a dependent until they're 24.
Okay.
But if they're not, it cuts off at 19. So here's the problem. Say your kid is 20 and you're claiming him as a dependent and he drops out of school and he doesn't have a job and he moves home, then you got a little bit of a problem because the child is not a full-time student but over 19. So the whole issue of claiming dependents is one of those complex ones. As I said, there are some. I get a lot of questions about people not only wanting to claim children but also parents. If you have disabled children, there's probably a whole other raft of regulations. This might be the kind of thing where you want to get some advice.
Sandy Block is with us this morning. She's the personal finance columnist for USA Today. She joins us this first hour to talk about some of the myths and the mistakes that people make in tax preparation. She's answering a lot of just questions from confused tax preparers as well. Next hour, Ruth Hayden on some of the myths and magical thinking around retirement planning. This ought to be interesting. People have no idea the amount of money. They think they need too much. They think they need too little as they plan for retirement. So we talk about that in the 10 o'clock hour. We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, more of your calls and your questions. If you're holding, stay with us. I'm also going to ask Sandy about electric and hybrid car tax credits. She wrote about that recently. There's some real money out there if you bought a hybrid or an electric car, and you're going to want to know about this. Back in a minute.
Support for this program comes from Medtronic, sponsor of the American Heart Association's Twin Cities Start Heart Walk, Saturday, June 5th at Target Field. You can learn how to start making a difference. Registration information at TwinCitiesHeartWalk.org.
On the next All Things Considered, it's testing time for Minnesota school children. But with changes in the works for the nation's main education law, are the tests still worthwhile? That story plus all the news, All Things Considered, weekdays starting at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Phil Picardi. The lightning rod congressman in the health care reform debate says he's retiring and won't seek another term. Michigan Democrat Bart Stupak was targeted for defeat by Tea Party activists because of his key role in passage of the landmark health care bill. Stupak says the Tea Party did not force him out. He says he's tired after 18 years in office and wants to spend more time with his family. North Korea is denouncing President Obama's nuclear policy as hostile, and it's vowing to keep building and expanding its arsenal of atomic weapons. The criticism from North Korea's foreign ministry was carried today by the country's official news agency. Obama earlier outlined a policy that prevents U.S. nuclear strikes on non-nuclear nations. The Army officer accused in the Fort Hood shooting has been moved from a military hospital to a jail near the Texas Post. According to online jail records, Major Nidal Hassan was listed as a Bell County jail inmate this morning. His attorney says his authorities didn't notify him of the transfer in advance. Hassan was left paralyzed by the gunfire at the base. Hassan is charged with 13 counts of premeditated murder and 32 counts of attempted premeditated murder. No injuries were reported after an early morning apartment fire in Sioux Falls. Authorities say the fire apparently began on the first level and quickly spread to the second and third floors. The fire was spotted by an off-duty firefighter who ran to the building and began knocking on windows to alert residents of the danger. A week after an apartment fire in Minneapolis that killed six people, officials say they're working on a plan to streamline the city's housing inspection process. Officials say the new system will help inspectors focus resources on problem properties. Residents of the Lake Street apartment building had complained about possible fire hazards. And in news that's just breaking, Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, the court's oldest member and leader of its liberal bloc, says he is retiring. President Barack Obama now has his second high court opening to fill. We'll hear more on that as the day rolls along. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
And we're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Carrie Miller. Again, coming up at 10 o'clock, we talk about retirement, the mistakes, the myths, the magical thinking that goes on around retirement planning. And that is at 10 with Ruth Hayden back in the studio. It's been a while since I've seen her, so this is going to be good to have her back in. On Monday morning at 9 o'clock, President Obama is headed to Florida next week, next Thursday, for a meeting with NASA about the space agency's future. We're going to talk about that. A lot of controversy about the direction that the president wants to take the space agency. And then a newsmaker segment about the nuclear summit that begins in Washington on Monday. So we'll be talking about NASA and the nuclear summit happening in Washington. That's all coming up on Monday. Sandra Block is with us this morning. She's the personal finance columnist for USA Today, and she's joining us from Washington to answer some of your questions about mistakes and myths and around tax planning. And Sandy, to the phones here, because we have full phone lines, to Jim in Minneapolis. Hi, Jim. You're on Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
See, I went from being a W-2 employee to becoming a 1099 self-employed individual mid-year. And because of that, I had to open up set up a home office, and it is used exclusively for business. So I've done a lot of research on taking the home deduction and the depreciation, which has led to a few different questions, obviously. And I'm wondering, this year I've done a quick calculation, and it's not going to be that much of a savings this year. So I'm wondering, if I don't take the home deduction this year, will that preclude me from taking it in future years when I have a full 12 months?
I'm not aware of any rule that says that that the fact that you took it one year doesn't mean that you can't take it the next. So I don't see any problem with that. It sounds like you've done your homework and that sort of thing. And you know, your situation is so common now because so many people have gone into business for themselves and are working for themselves, and the home office deduction is a big. But I don't think it would hurt you to not take it this year. It sounds like you sort of laid the groundwork, so maybe you're in a better position to take it next year.
And then just a couple of quick follow-up questions on that same topic, if I could.
Quickly.
Cost basis-wise, I know that you have to depreciate the home, and then that does then, in fact, lower your cost basis when you eventually sell the home. But there's a $250,000 exemption for gain on home.
Yeah, if you're married, it's $500,000. So I wrote about this a few years ago. Again, I hate to keep punting to professionals, but if you think you're going to sell soon, I would talk to somebody, because I have heard professionals recommend not claiming the home office deduction if you plan to sell your home, because the depreciation could hurt your ability to take advantage of that exemption from capital gains taxes. So since you're not going to do it this year, you've got time. Before you do it next year, you might want to talk to somebody and just make sure that that is the right course for you.
50, then it wouldn't even really be an issue, would it?
Excuse me?
I say, if I didn't expect the gain to be greater than the 250, even with the depreciation figured in, then
I don't think so. But again, like I said, I would check with somebody first.
Jim, sounds like some questions for the pros. Thanks very much for the call. Sandy here from Eric in Duluth asks, how about donations that are made through purchasing from companies who are donating a portion or all of their proceeds to charity?
I don't think you can deduct those. One of the sort of hard and fast rules of charity is that you can't deduct anything that benefits you. If you go to a dinner and they say that the profits are, you know, that part of the proceeds will go to charity, you can only deduct the portion that doesn't cover what you ate. And when you buy something, arguably the entire product, even if the charity says, yeah, we're going to give a few percentage of the, you know, sales or something to charity, you're buying something for yourself. So I'm not aware of any way that you can deduct anything when the charity says that they're going to give part of the proceeds to, or the company says they're going to give part of the proceeds to charity.
So it's like when you are receiving something of value,
right,
for that contribution, you cannot deduct it.
Right. And, okay. and anyone who's ever, I run a lot of races, and, you know, I've gone to dinners and fundraisers, and most big legitimate charities are very good about telling you, you know, if you wrote them a check, how much of that check benefited you and how much of it went to charity.
I want to ask you about the hybrids and the electric cars deduction, because this is significant money here. hybrid car $3,000 if you bought one in 2009, and more if you bought an electric car, right?
Well, now, the hybrid car is going to be a tough one to claim because basically that credit phased out after the hybrid manufacturers sold a certain number of cars. And the bottom line is it is no longer available for the most popular hybrids. If you bought a Prius, any Toyota product, a Honda, even a Ford last year, you're either going to get no credit or reduced amount. So I don't think you're going to get $3,000 credit on any hybrid vehicles now because that credit is basically going away. Where you can really claim a big credit are the next generation of cars. Nissan announced about a week ago that they're going to start selling the Nissan Leaf. It's a plug-in electric car. If you are an early adopter and buy that car, you are eligible for a credit of up to $7,500. So basically, Nissan is promoting this big time because the car retails for $33,600, but if you claim the credit, that knocks it back to $26,100, which isn't cheap, but is a lot less than the electric, the Tesla or some of the electric cars that the ones that are already out there. So I think that's where it's going to get interesting. I think the hybrid tax credit, unless Congress revives it, which I doubt, because hybrids are sort of becoming mainstream enough that they don't feel the need to encourage people to buy these. The next generation of interesting credits are going to be the next generation of interesting cars, which are plug-ins.
All right. Good to know. From Lorna online here in Minneapolis, she says, is there a maximum household income level that disqualifies me from deducting job hunting expenses? I've been unemployed all year. My husband makes $125,000.
I don't think so. I mean, at a certain level, some of your deductions will be phased out. But I'm not aware of any cutoff in her ability. The problem she's going to have is if they file jointly, which most married couples do, her total job hunting expenses and all of her other miscellaneous deductions have to exceed a certain threshold for her to claim that. And if her husband makes up that much money, she may not have enough expenses to claim, but the ability to claim them is not affected. It's just she would need a lot more expensive to overcome that threshold.
All right, to the phones to Mike in Stillwater. Hi, Mike. I appreciate you waiting.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about these magic numbers upcoming, at least $200,000 for individuals and $250,000 for dual-income married couples as regards the Bush tax phase-outs and some of these other pending likely tax increases, both on capital gains and likely income tax related. At what point is a two-income family making hypothetically $175,000 a piece better off being divorced in the eyes of the state?
Jeez, I don't. Mike, you're telling me you might get a divorce just to save some tax money? Did I hear that?
Well, in the eyes of the state, does this amount to a significant marriage penalty?
That's a good question there used to be a marriage penalty, and then, during the Bush years, they took steps to make it less onerous. I don't know. That's a good thing to pursue as we move forward with the expiration of these tax cuts, whether married couples will be better off not being married, whether that's going to reinstate the marriage penalty. But frankly, I'm so busy right now working on people's current tax situations, I haven't had time to focus on that, but it's a really good question.
Online here, Sandy from Jenny in St. Paul, she says, is April 15th the deadline only if you owe? Is the extension for deployed soldiers an automatic, or do you have to apply for that?
I apologize for not being totally up to date on the tax rules for military people. I know there are some exceptions, but I would apply. I mean, it's a quick form. You get it in. Just go ahead and file by April 15th. If you don't owe anything, it'll take you 5 minutes, and you got 6 months to file. And certainly if you're in the military, I would encourage that because I'm sure you got other things on your mind.
Sandy Block is with us. She's the personal finance columnist for USA Today. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about some of the mistakes people make as they're preparing their taxes and some of the myths, just these ideas that seem to settle into the culture that people believe about filing for taxes that aren't necessarily true. And if you have a question for her, 800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. If you're online, mprnewsq.org. Click on send us a question. I also want to let you know that we're on top of this breaking news coming out of Washington here that Justice John Paul Stevens has announced that he will retire this summer, and we're looking for some analysts to try to give us some perspective on that. I'll let you know if we have found some. To Dave in Minneapolis. Hi, Dave. You're on Mid Morning. Hi, Dave. Are you there?
Yep.
All right. Your question for Sandy, please.
Yep. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not a U.S. citizen, and I've paid my taxes the last 8 years. I'm working on a, like they call it, a work visa thing.
Uh-huh.
My question is, do I qualify to file a tax rebate on the student loan which I paid for my wife?
I'm not aware of any tax rebates for student loans to begin with, and I apologize in advance for not being really familiar with laws that apply to individuals who pay taxes here but are not U.S. citizens. But the only thing I know with respect to student loans is that the interest is potentially deductible, and that may be what the caller is talking about. But again, like I said, I just don't know how that plays out if you're not a citizen.
Where would you be able to get an answer on that, do you think, Sandy?
Oh, geez. Well, I would go ahead and file an extension to get some more time and then talk to maybe an enrolled agent, look for somebody who has some experience with I get some referrals perhaps from some other folks you know in similar situation. I would look for someone with some very specific experience in dealing with folks who are not citizens.
I want to ask you about medical expenses because you wrote about this in a column, and I think people get confused about this. You say you can only deduct the amount of unreimbursed medical expenses that exceeds 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Now, tell me, does that include prescription drugs? Does it include elective medical procedures? What?
It includes anything, and this, what I'm talking about here are not folks who are self-employed, and there's a whole different set of rules for them. But if you are working and you are covered by your employer's insurance, but you have a very large deductible, lots of copays or expenses that aren't reimbursed, then if you add all those up and they exceed 7.5% of your AGI, then you can deduct the amount that exceeds that. Non-prescription drugs are not included. Anything cosmetic is not included. But anything that was medical, dental, that was not reimbursed by your insurance is included. And what reason I wrote about this is because so many people got their salaries cut last year or wages frozen or were furloughed, but perhaps they had high medical expenses. They may be able to exceed that 7.5% threshold, which is normally pretty high. So it's worth looking at everything that you paid out, particularly if you had a rough year medically, to see if you might be able to deduct some of those expenses.
All right, to Peter in Minneapolis. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. Your question for Sandy.
So I am self-employed, and I am curious if I use rewards cards that either pay me cash back or I use to buy tickets, things like that, do I have to declare those items as income?
I am not aware of those things ever being considered income. The only time I recall it being an issue was with some employed people getting lots of frequent flyer miles, and there were some questions maybe raised about that. I don't think you have to declare that as income.
All right. Thanks for the call. Sandy, a question here about travel expenses and small businesses. Is it true that a lot of small business owners are not taking as many deductions as they could when it comes to travel?
I think so. I think so because it's pretty much that any travel related to your business, business trips, mileage, tolls, parking, even maintenance of your car are potentially deductible. What you have to be careful of is if you are self-employed, you probably are using your car for both personal and business use, and then you have to basically prorate and figure out the percentage of mileage that was used for business and the percentage that was used for personal. Same way with travel. If you go on a trip and you do some business and then you also spend some time on the beach, you can't deduct the entire amount.
What if the travel expense applies to a specific profession? Let's say you're a historian or an archaeologist or something, and you're traveling, but you're doing what you've just said. You're combining, you know, the purposes of the travel, but you work for somebody else again. You don't have a small business.
Well, if you work for somebody else, it's very unlikely that you can deduct any of these costs unless the company is requiring you to go and will not reimburse you for your expenses. But if you're traveling on business and the company's paying for it, then none of it's deductible.
Well, yeah.
But if you go on vacation, yeah, I think it could get dicey. If you go on vacation and maybe you take a class that might help your job, I'm not sure that that would be considered deductible either. If your company says, you must go to Belize and do some research for us and we're not going to pay you for it, then that's an unreimbursed business expense and you might be able to deduct some of it.
Okay. To Doug in Minneapolis. Hi, Doug. You're on Mid Morning.
Hi. How are you doing this morning?
Good. Your question.
My question, is there a tax credit for having three or more children?
No, well, you get to there should be. You get to claim them. It depends on your situation. I mean, certainly you claim them as dependents, and that gives you a pretty big tax credit. And if you fall into a certain low-income bracket, you may be eligible for the earned income tax credit, which has actually been expanded this year and probably applies to a lot more people than realize it because of the economy. And in that case, the more children you have, the larger your credit. So there is a credit for low-income families with any children, and those with three or more can claim a larger amount.
There ought to be a special status, shouldn't there, for people who have...
Well, actually, on the high-income end, what people used to complain to me all about is the alternative minimum tax credit.
Yeah.
We penalize people with lots of kids. So there's actually, in some cases, a tax penalty for having many children, but most people get a pretty good tax break for having kids.
Hey, we haven't talked about the AMT, and I haven't heard much about it this year. Why not?
Maybe because nobody's making any money. But, you know, what Congress has done every year is sort of patched it to keep it from getting worse. So probably people who paid it in the past had to pay it again, but there wasn't a big increase in the number of people who had to pay it, so that's perhaps why we didn't hear such a hue and cry about it. It's still out there. It's still a problem that needs to be fixed, but it's part of a much larger, you know, looming issue in the tax code that lawmakers just haven't had the stomach to manage.
And it's expensive to fix it, isn't it?
It's hugely expensive.
Yeah.
That's the problem. If you get rid of it, you give up trillions and trillions of dollars.
Yeah, and that won't happen anytime soon,
no,
will it?
No, I don't think so.
To Chris in Duluth. Hi, Chris. Your question for Sandy.
Hi, yes. I'm wondering, I'm in a situation where I live with a domestic partner, and I'm wondering, I own a house, and I live in a house, and we plan to stay here forever. And the question is, could I theoretically sell half the house to my domestic partner and then draft a deed and make the sale price whatever it is, and then in turn have my partner claim the $8,000 tax credit?
No, because no, I don't think you could do that. I mean, and frankly, you know, with a home buyer credit, the IRS, because there was really a lot of fraud in this, the IRS is paying pretty close attention to it. I mean, you can talk to a tax pro and see if that works, but I got a feeling your partner's been living in that house.
Yeah.
The fact that you're not married is not going to count. Your partner's still been living in the house, so it's not considered a new home or a first-time home purchase. So I don't see how that would work. You can consult with somebody, but my just gut reaction is I don't think so.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Online here from Lauren in St. Paul, she says, what's the difference between a tax deduction and a tax credit? I think this is a good question.
It's a great question, and it's an area of much misconception. If you have a choice, you always want to take the tax credit. A tax credit is a dollar-for-dollar reduction in your taxes. So let's say the $1,500 energy tax bill tax credit reduces your tax bill by $1,500. A deduction is a reduction in your taxable income. So you only get a percentage of the total amount of the deduction. So say you've got a $5,000 deduction and a $5,000 credit, or say you've got a $6,000 deduction and a $5,000 credit. The $5,000 credit is still going to be worth a lot more because the value of deduction is going to be based on what your tax bracket is. And as I said, it's only going to reduce the amount of income that is taxed.
Good clarification. So, Sandy, do you have any hope that the tax code, which just seems to get more complicated year by year, that there is any real serious move here to simplify it?
I don't. I have no hope.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's because it's such an easy way for Congress has just gotten very much in the habit of using the tax code to reward or penalize certain behaviors.
Yeah.
The homebuyer credit is a great example. It's, you know, insane. It's very complicated. We're getting all these questions about it, but people want to use it. And the reason that it was created was to try and get people to go out and buy homes and improve the economy. And as long as Congress views the tax code as a way to shape behavior, I don't see any hope that they will make it easier. So it's interesting because people complain about how complicated the tax code is and how it should be simpler, and yet they want, you know, you say, well, would you be willing to give up the deduction on your interest on your mortgage? And they scream, they say, no way.
Yeah.
You know, so we like it. We complain about it, but we also like it.
Sandra Block is the personal finance columnist for USA Today. She's joining us today from Washington. Sandy, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for fielding all of these questions and such good advice. We really appreciate
it. Thank you, Carrie.
Send a letter to me. Don't forget to write each day.
I've heard from a lot of you about the shows we've done this week. Our discussion about the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church elicited many, many comments. A listener who wanted to remain anonymous wrote in to say her father was the victim of clergy abuse in Canada and that it damaged his marriage and his relationships with those he loved. She added, my favorite bumper sticker is, I like your Christ, it's your Christians I can't stand. Lucia Crane wrote to say she was disappointed with the lack of historical and what she called proportional context in our discussions. She closed by saying, I ardently hope that you will devote another program to this issue where you will attempt to present a more complete, fair, and intellectually sophisticated report. That would be an important service to your listeners. By the way, you can find those two shows that we did on the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal in the mid-morning archives. Paul Ottaviano heard our show about political vitriol and wrote in to say that he didn't like it. He said, Ms. Miller, you were much too, what's the word I'm looking for, much too gracious, much too bipartisan towards Sarah Palin and all the right-wing maniacs. And finally, University of Wisconsin Professor Emeritus Randall Ryder wrote to say he liked the discussion yesterday about aging parents. He's created a website that organizes information and resources for people facing the situation that our guest Jonathan Rauch faced. I checked out the site. There's a lot of valuable information there, and you can find it at elderparenthelp.com. Critics, comments, praise, you can email me at kmiller@npr.org, and I may read your email on the air.
I'll stop to count the kisses that you put down for me, and I'll know that I'll be wishing you could be back here with me. Send a letter to me. Don't forget to write each day. Then maybe I won't feel that you're quite so far away. Send a letter to me. Send a letter to me.
Mid-Morning is produced by Chris Dahl, Nancy Liebens, and Susan Leem. We have technical help from Randy Johnson, Cliff Bentley, Steve Griffith, and Johnny Vince Evans. And I'm Carrie Miller.
Each weekday, Minnesota Public Radio News invites you to join the conversation on NPRNewsQ.org. The United States and Russia have agreed to a new weapons treaty that, if ratified, will lead to modest cuts in nuclear arsenals. Today's question, should the world's nuclear countries work toward eliminating such weapons? Go to NPRNewsQ.org to leave your answer and see the answers of others, or send a text to 677-677. We'll share some of your answers this afternoon on All Things Considered.